Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Dr. Arthur Agatston, who reads from and discusses his new book, The South Beach Heart Program, The Four-Step Plan That Can Save Your Life, published by Rodale. In the weeks to come, we have Tracy Chevalier, Rachel Johnson, Jonathan Lethem, Sarah Davidson, Craig Childs, and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good afternoon and welcome. On behalf of the Tattered Cover, I'd like to take this opportunity to thank you for your support of independent bookselling. Dr. Arthur Agatston is a cardiologist and an associate professor of medicine at the University of Miami Miller School of Medicine. Over the years, his pioneering work in non-invasive cardiac imaging has resulted in cardiac and coronary scanning and screening methods that continue to bear his name. In 2004, Dr. Agatston founded the Agatston Research Foundation for the purpose of conducting and funding original research on diet, cardiac function, and disease prevention. The foundation is dedicated to improving the heart health and wellness of the nation through research, education, and prevention. He is the author of the best-selling book, The South Beach Diet, and we are delighted to have him here today to discuss his new book, The South Beach Heart Program, The Four-Step Plan That Can Save Your Life. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Arthur Agatston.
Thank you very much, Heather. It's wonderful to be here. I, in some ways, don't feel like I left Miami Beach with your weather here today. It's absolutely sensational. It's funny being here in a sense as a diet doctor who now is talking about heart prevention, and really for those who know me, and actually there are a few here, Dr. Ehrlich, Dr. Flanagan, who do know me from my heart prevention days. The South Beach diet really started accidentally as part of the prevention puzzle. My interest first was in preventing heart attacks, and particularly with an interest in non-invasive imaging of the heart. And we started non-invasive imaging, seeing arteriosclerosis years before it could cause a heart attack, back in the late 1980s and early 90s. And once we were seeing all this disease, the question was what to do about it. And along came the statin drugs. The first was Mevacor and Provacol, and now Zocor and Lipitor and Crestor. And all of a sudden, we could really lower cholesterol effectively. And we thought, that's the end of cardiology. Just put the drugs in the drinking water or give it to everybody. But there was a problem that the drugs could decrease heart attack rates about 30%, which was fantastic. But if you think of walking into a patient's room with pneumonia and say, I have a great new drug for you, we have a 30% chance of curing you, they wouldn't be too happy. And I wasn't too happy with just a 30% rate. And what I was finding in my practice was I was finding my patients, in fact, the country, and frankly myself, were getting fatter on the low-fat diet, high-carb diet that was then recommended by the government. And it wasn't only my experience. Cardiologists were really not counseling patients on diet at all because they found it didn't work. And they were just using the drugs, but that wasn't a good answer. And in the early 90s, there was a lot of new information about nutrition that frankly wasn't available to Atkins or Ornish or Pritikin or the Heart Association in the 60s and 70s. It was a combination of things that we all of a sudden began to really understand: the role of fiber in slowing digestion and controlling our blood sugars, the concept of glycemic index, how fast a food causes swings in blood sugar, the role of good fats, that fats were not necessarily bad for us. They could be good for us. And as a result of this, we came up with a good fats, good carb diet. And we tried it in our patients, and with really great success. For the first time, I was having success with patients losing weight, improving their cholesterol values. And we began to report our experience and doing some small clinical trials and reporting them at national meetings. And in the late 1990s, local ABC affiliate, Channel 10, asked us to put South Florida on the diet. And all of a sudden, it went from an academic and clinical project to being out in the real world. And one of the tensions about going out to the public was that doctors, it was always felt that, you know, doctors should be speaking at medical meetings and writing for journals, but not really for the public. And if I'm writing for the public, do I call the diet the modified carbohydrate diet, which was the technical name we had first given to it, or do I take advantage of the fact that we lived in South Beach, where, as my wife sometimes says, that nobody really cares when they die as long as they look thin and good and healthy when they do. And one of the things that influenced me was an article I had read in the Wall Street Journal about the statin companies and the results of their advertising. Doctors also never like to see advertising for anything, for procedures or for medications. And what this article pointed out was that the pharmaceutical companies had spent millions and millions of dollars trying to educate physicians to use more of the statin drugs in particular, which did lower heart attack rates significantly. And by rather conservative national guidelines, back then it was the 1993 national guidelines, by those guidelines, only about 15% of patients who it was felt could benefit from the statin drugs were actually taking the statin drugs. And so the pharmaceutical companies decided, we're going to continue to try to educate physicians, but maybe we should go to the public. And that's when they advertised directly to the public, and doctors didn't particularly like having patients come to their offices saying, shouldn't I be on this drug? But what was documented was more patients who actually appropriately could benefit from the drugs were after the advertising. And it made me, you know, think about the benefits of going directly to the public. And we decided to, naturally, and wrote the book. And one of my other frustrations, I should particularly say, with Jim here, was in developing the heart scan, which I did with Dr. Janowitz back in 1988, we thought we had a really good technique that detected heart disease early. It measured the amount of calcium in the coronary arteries. We knew that calcium reflected the amount of arteriosclerosis you had in your heart. That was not controversial. We knew the amount of arteriosclerosis. It was arteriosclerosis that caused heart attacks, and the more you had, the more likely you were to get a heart attack from angiographic studies. And so we didn't think it was a really big jump of faith to say that the amount of calcium, which reflected the amount of arteriosclerosis, might predict heart attacks. And we were kind of amazed that this was not immediately embraced by the medical community, something that seemed completely logical. And we did become convinced that there was a lot of politics, a lot of inertia. And actually, I was thinking about it this morning. You know, when you have a good idea and decide to try to get studies funded, there's unfortunately, this is just normally the way things happen. There's a lot of things that go into whether particular studies get funded, and I developed a bias that prevention was not being funded like certain other studies, and so we started decided to go directly to the public and to give it the sexy name, because if nobody read the science in the book, it wouldn't be very very helpful. And so we did it. Now, I never expected it to take off like it did, but I also feel the book did a lot to educate the public on what we all agree are the principles of good nutrition. We are absolutely beyond the low-fat versus low-carbohydrate debates. It's reflected in the new USDA diet pyramid and the new Heart Association guidelines, and probably every new diet book you'll pick up will have the principles that we're beyond low-fat versus low-carb. The principles are the right fats, particularly the Mediterranean oils like olive oil, canola oil, and very important, the omega-3 oils from both fish and from plant sources like in walnuts and flaxseed. The right carbohydrates, vegetables, whole fruits, whole grains. You can have a high carbohydrate diet if you're choosing the right carbohydrates. And the last is lean sources of protein. And various societies do well with various percentages of carbohydrate, protein, and fat. But they only do well if they're consuming the right one. So it's really the quality of the food rather than the quantity. And I think the evidence for this was overwhelming when we wrote the book. But again, it just wasn't out there. Now today, you know, when you see advertisements for breakfast cereal, you hear whole grain, whole grain, whole grain, one of the good carbohydrates. 10 years ago, you didn't hear that. And I think it was going to the public and bringing things out to the open that did stimulate a lot of the changes in national guidelines, because the science was already there. And it was the public that I think helped force the improvement in guidelines. Now, while I did learn from Dr. Atkins and the Atkins diet in that high fat didn't necessarily make you fat, there were important limitations of the Atkins diet, mainly the emphasis on saturated fat and the denial of all carbohydrates, including the good carbohydrates. But it was interesting that Dr. Atkins was never taken seriously by the nutritional establishment at all, that studies after studies studying low-fat, high-carbohydrate diets were accepted by the NIH and, you know, government institutions. And if you came in, well, I'm going to study high-fat, you were not going to get it funded. At the same time, the public was voting with their dollars, buying Atkins and not the Heart Association diet. And my point is that while I don't think he got it completely right, he should have been taken more seriously, and it should have, you know, it should have been studied. Well, fast forward to heart disease. Over the last 10 to 15 years, there's been a real revolution in the prevention of heart disease, to the point that today the great majority of heart attacks and strokes are absolutely preventable. And they are being prevented. Cardiologists and internists around the country who are practicing aggressive prevention have been seeing heart attacks and strokes literally disappear from their practices. I was at a meeting in New York put together by Dr. Fuster, the chief of cardiology at Mount Sinai in New York. It's a yearly, very large meeting. And I ran into a colleague of mine who had been the head of the intensive care unit at Mount Sinai when I was hospital-based, and was never particularly interested in prevention, but a good, solid cardiologist who was now out in private practice. We saw each other, sat down, listened to Dr. Fuster's excellent lecture. And the next lecture was on classic heart attacks, what's called an ST elevation myocardial infarction. And we noticed that we were starting to catch up on our kids, and hadn't seen each other in a while, and talking about the kids and the family. And David finally said to me, while the guy's in the middle of the lecture, he said, "Arthur, have you seen an ST elevation heart attack in your practice in the last whatever?" I said, "No." He said, "I haven't either." And this type of conversation I've been having, in a sense, for years. First with people who are really oriented towards prevention, but now from other cardiologists, that wasn't their first orientation, but they're using the latest knowledge, the latest imaging, to treat their patients. Now, if the great majority of heart attacks and strokes are preventable, you know, why haven't you heard about it? Why don't you know? And I might say the great, great majority of bypass surgeries and angioplasties are absolutely unnecessary. They're preventable, and many of them are done for the wrong reasons, which we'll talk about in a minute. So, you know, this the fact that we can prevent heart attacks and strokes, it pops up in various newspaper articles, you know, here and there in conversation, but it's overall absolutely flown under the radar. And this is at a time when the baby boomers are entering the coronary age group, where more and more people are at risk for heart attacks, where insurance costs are going up and up and up to the point that if we wait to treat disease after the fact, the cost is going to simply be prohibitive. And you hear about this and what it costs, you know, the problems General Motors has with health insurance and selling cars, that compared to Japan, the number of dollars you spend when you buy a car that goes to the health care of General Motors workers is preventing them from competing. And so we're not going to be able to sustain this level of interventions and heart attacks economically, as well as all the human costs. And so the purpose of the South Beach Heart Program is really, in a sense, whistleblowing and to empower the public in two ways with the information about how to prevent heart disease. One, to navigate the medical system as it is today. That when you have to go to your doctor, and you may feel your doctor has less time for you than he had before, and is distracted by outside concerns, you're right. He does have less time for you. Because of the overhead in medical care, primary care physicians find they have to see 50 patients a day, or they have to somehow generate procedures to make ends meet. And they are more and more distracted. They're more and more unhappy. In fact, primary care doctors are going out of practice at record rates. They're retiring, and they're not being replaced by young doctors because the quality of practice has deteriorated. So your doctor will likely have less time for you, and it's important that you be educated in the heart risk factors, in the latest tests, and your own medical history so that you can use your time very efficiently and get the best care out of the medical system as it is today. But the other thing is that we want to empower the public to influence lawmakers and others so that we begin to create incentives for prevention rather than just for intervention, so that we really begin to change the entire healthcare system. And so I really want to get out on the stump and yell at the top of my lungs, you don't have to have a heart attack. It is absolutely prevented. It is being prevented. And so why are we still doing all these interventions? And it's really for a number of reasons. When I went to medical school and during my cardiology training in the 1970s, we were taught that coronary artery disease was like plumbing. And the coronary arteries, which bring blood from the aorta when the heart beats, the left ventricle is the main pumping chamber of the heart. It pushes blood out the aorta, which gives off coronary arteries, which supply the heart muscle with blood. And if the artery gets blocked and the heart muscle doesn't get the blood, that heart muscle dies and that's causes a heart attack. And we were told that those coronary arteries were like drain pipes and they built up gradually with sludge. The sludge was called arteriosclerosis. And when the sludge got to block the artery by about 70%, you'd begin to have chest pain with exertion. When you needed more oxygen and blood to your heart muscle with exercise, you couldn't get the extra blood through one of the arteries that was 70% blocked. The heart muscle would, in a sense, cry out for more blood, and that would be what we call angina. That would be chest pain from the lack of blood flow through the coronary artery. And as the blockage became 80%, 90% blocked, you'd have pain with less exertion, and finally it would close completely, and you'd have a heart attack. And that's what I learned. The logical response to this gradual closure of the artery was to find these blockages when they were 60, 70, 80%, and Roto-Rooter to open them with angioplasties, with stents, or bypass them before they became 90, 95, 100% blocked and caused a heart attack. That was logical, and that's what we all did for years. But there were certain problems with this, what I call plumber's view of heart disease. For one thing, in clinical practice, we didn't see people who, say, would have chest pain with 20 blocks exertion, and then a few months later would be with 15, with 10, with 5, and then have a heart attack. Syndromes didn't change like that. People would suddenly get chest pain in the midst of a heart attack, or they might first notice chest pain when they go hiking or ride a bike, something they haven't done for a while, but the pattern of chest pain wouldn't progress as if the artery was gradually closing. And the other thing was the bypass surgeries and the angioplasties that were supposedly opening these 70, 80% blockages and preventing them from closing the whole artery and causing a heart attack, they weren't preventing heart attacks. Now, in the acute, if you're in the midst of acute heart attack, which is a sudden closure of an artery, bypass surgery and angioplasty can be life-saving. But in the chronic patient, it wasn't preventing heart attacks, even though to this day, doctors are doing these procedures every single day, telling their patients they're going to prevent a heart attack. Well, the way it actually works, it turns out the plumbing view was really all wrong. And the view that we all agree, and what I'm telling you is not controversial in the medical literature, but it's not the standard, the basis of the standard of care in the community, was what I like to call the healer's view of heart disease. That the artery doesn't start to block like diffuse sludge, just gradually closing. The arteriosclerosis starts like little pimples in the vessel wall, But instead of being filled with pus, they're filled with cholesterol. And they grow out in the vessel wall, and the overall vessel gets larger. So the flow of blood through the center of the vessel can be completely normal, even though you have these little pimples, what we call soft plaques, filled with cholesterol, growing up all over your arteries. Well, when they grow to a certain point, and there are several factors that can cause them to pop, but at some point, they pop or they rupture. And that rupture causes an ulceration, an injury to the artery, to the inside of the artery. And you respond just like when you cut your hand, you bleed and you develop a blood clot and a scab. Well, that's the way the coronary artery tries to injure tries to heal itself after these little pimples popping or soft plaque explosions, breaking the integrity of the inner lining of the vessel. And you develop a blood clot. If the blood clot is big enough to block the artery, that's what causes a sudden heart attack. And that's why somebody can pass a stress test, can feel absolutely fine one day or the same day, and then all of a sudden have chest pain and have a complete blockage. It doesn't happen gradually. It happens suddenly. And now most of these little plaque ruptures or plaque explosions of the pimples don't result in a blood clot that occludes the whole vessel. Most of them heal, and they may block 10% of the vessel, 20%, 50%, or 70% or 80%. But you don't feel it when it happens. If it blocks, say, 80% of the vessel, it heals over. And if you do something vigorous, you travel up north or go on a hike, you may then feel chest pain because not enough blood is getting past that 80% blockage when you're climbing up a mountain. But when you rest, the pain goes away. And it turns out that 80% blockage that's healed, it's a healed blood clot, just like on your skin, like a scab. That once it heals and it becomes scar tissue, it doesn't grow any further. It doesn't become 80, 90, or 100%. And there was a famous study showing this when patients had angiograms showing this various blockages. If somebody had a 90% blockage and 2 years later had a heart attack, the heart attack wasn't from the site where there was a 90% blockage. It was from someplace else. And so what I'm telling you is that most of these lesions, these so-called 70, 80, 90% blockages that we've been going after are not actually the lesions that heal, that kill us. They're healed lesions. And now we understand why bypass surgery and angioplasty doesn't prevent heart attacks. Now, if you're having chest pain, if you're hiking, you have the pain, and you want to hike without pain, you can be treated medically, or you can have an angioplasty, and that will help relieve the pain, but it won't prevent a heart attack. Now, again, what I'm telling you is absolutely there in the medical literature. It's what you hear at meetings, but it's not there in the community. Last year we did, I think, 1.5 million, over a million angioplasties, about 500,000 bypass surgeries. And absolutely most of them are unnecessary and costing a huge amount. But if you have these little pimples growing up that are the real, like, ticking time bombs, and a good percentage of Americans have them growing, how do you know? Well, you know with a combination of advanced testing, both imaging studies and blood tests. The imaging studies are very good today, but one thing we should all realize that every year they're getting better and better and better. And when patients ask me about, do they have to worry about their kids when parents had heart problems, my answer is no. By the time their 10-year-old, 15-year-old grows into the age where they're at risk, this is all going to be solved. We'll see everything in plenty of time, and we'll know exactly what to give each patient. But we're pretty close today. And the way we tell that those pimples are there, we actually can't see them directly, non-invasively from outside the body. But those healed plaques that we talked about after a plaque rupture that doesn't actually cause a heart attack, they develop calcium. That's part of the healing process, just like people who have little injuries to their shoulder and there's calcific bursitis. And that's just a response of the body to injury. When it heals, a certain percentage or a lot of these plaques get calcium, and that we can see with the heart scan and the calcium score. And now it's been argued, well, we're seeing the lesions that I just told you are not going to kill you. And that's true. But every one of those calcified spots on the scan was a potential heart attack that maybe didn't happen. But the more calcium you have, the higher your calcium score, the more likely you have other pimples or soft plaques growing that can rupture, that can cause a heart attack in the future. And everybody has their own level of cholesterol where it's actually building up in the coronary arteries. And so we see little old ladies with cholesterols over 300 who all of a sudden find out their cholesterol is over 300 or in a panic, and they have squeaky clean vessels. That's because there are other characteristics of their cholesterol that protects the arteries from actually building up the plaques. And then we have people with cholesterols less than 200 whose plaques, whose arteries are vulnerable to the lower levels of cholesterol and who are building up plaque and are at risk for heart attacks. And so the best way is with the modern scans, the calcium score for the heart, by looking at the carotid arteries with ultrasound, which is done very easily. You can also see evidence of arteriosclerosis years before it causes a stroke. The other part of the cardiac revolution over the last 10, 15 years is advanced blood testing, and it's continuing to advance. So we're learning about new risk factors, new ways to measure our risk, and new targets to treat all the time. But one important thing that I'll go over is the size of the cholesterol particles. I had a patient, I always remember back in the mid-1980s, who was diabetic and who had had heart attacks, bypass surgery, carotid disease, all kinds of problems. It was before the first statin drugs. He was on nothing good to lower his cholesterol. He was not responsive to low-fat diet. But his cholesterol was 145, what we considered absolutely safe and protective. He was diabetic. How could he possibly have all this disease with a cholesterol that low? Well, what we realize now, it was the type of cholesterol particles he had. Cholesterol is needed for your body's normal function. And cholesterol is brought from your liver to your organs with particles that are like little shuttle buses that shuttle the cholesterol to the organs, dump it off where it's used to make cell walls, it's used to make hormones, and excess is brought back to the liver. If there's excess cholesterol in the organs, in the vessels, it's brought back to the liver by also another shuttle bus. Brings the cholesterol back to the liver where it's excreted. Well, the shuttle bus that brings cholesterol to the organs and to vessels is called LDL cholesterol, or you can think of as the lousy cholesterol, because it causes, if there's excess, and you're delivering beyond what your organs need, the excess is what builds up these pimples that grow and can explode and cause heart attacks. And the shuttle buses that shuttle the cholesterol away are called the HDL or the healthy cholesterol. And they pick up the cholesterol like little vacuum cleaners from the vessel wall, from the pimples, and bring it back to the liver. And if you manipulate the amount of LDL lousy and the amount of decreased amount of lousy cholesterol, increase the amount of good cholesterol, you can regress these pimples. You can dry it up. You can heal it. But as far as the total cholesterols and total LDL and HDL, what we found out in recent years was that if the shuttle bustles are really small, the LDL particles are really small, they burrow into the vessel walls more easily than the big particles. And if the healthy HDL shuttle buses are also very small, they don't do a good job of clearing the cholesterol out of the vessel wall. And it turns out the size of the lousy and the healthy cholesterol particles is as important as the total amount, which really reflects the total amount of particles. So in retrospect, what I realized and what I've learned patient after patient is that most of these people with low cholesterols who are still at risk, still building up plaque, it's because they have very small shuttle buses, very small particles that are causing the buildup of the soft plaques, not cleaning them out. And that's why total cholesterols and the traditional numbers alone can be very misleading. And there are other numbers. You've heard about inflammation, C-reactive protein. There are many others that we are able to measure today. And with diet, exercise, and medication, we can make the LDL and the HDL particles bigger. And when we do that, we really find that we can prevent future heart attacks and strokes. So our approach today is to see who's at risk, starting with men around age 40, women after menopause around age 50, because they are protected before menopause. If there's risk factors, any of the traditional risk factors, high blood pressure, family history, then we do the imaging and we do both the traditional good and bad cholesterol, but also the size of the particles and several other tests. And so we determine first who's at risk, who's actually building up the disease. And there's a long window of opportunity to identify the disease. If you're 45 or 50 and heading for a heart attack at 55 or 60, the disease is already in the vessel walls. In fact, it was in there probably from the time you were in your 20s. 25% of Vietnam casualties, when they looked at their arteries, had plaque, had raised plaque. So it's a lifelong process. You don't die with your first little plaque. And so there's a great long window of opportunity to image atherosclerosis in the heart and the carotids before they cause a heart attack or stroke. Then with the advanced blood testing, we can tell what has to be treated, how much diet and exercise is likely to help or can help alone, or how much you need the modern medications. And once you're at risk, it's usually a combination. Usually you can't get away with just diet and exercise or just with medications. You need a combination of both. But the good news is this technology and knowledge is here today. It's being practiced, and the purpose of the book is really to alert the public, because if we only reported this at medical meetings, frankly, people would be having bypass surgeries and dying for I don't know how many more years. But you know, what I call the healers, the doctors practicing aggressive prevention in the manner I described, they're going to win. All the medical literature is on their side. It's just a question of how long is it going to take. And I feel that alerting the public to to this, just to the fact that heart disease is preventable today, will help push the ball down the field and achieve the goal, where the standard of care becomes the healing approach, not the plumbing approach. And so I am optimistic. You're not going to have to worry about your kids. They're not going to have a heart attack or a stroke when they grow up. But for young adults, middle-aged adults, shouldn't have to have heart attacks either. And so I hope with the publicity and getting the word out there will accelerate the time to the fact that we can save millions of lives and billions of dollars. And I'll stop there. Thank you, and open the floor for questions. Mm-hmm. Yoga is certainly a form of what we call core exercise. And one thing we talk about in the book is the importance of core exercise. My practice, while it's cardiology, many days I feel more like an orthopedist because I always ask patients about what exercise they're doing. And the answer so often is, well, I was exercising, but my back went out, my rotator cuff. I didn't know what a rotator cuff was in medical school, but all my patients have one now. And the reason is we're all slumping over computers all day. And then we often go to the gym and we do bench presses or isolated bicep presses, and we're ignoring the core muscles that support our joints. And so what happens, we may have big muscles that look good in the mirror and on the beach, but I have patients who have gone home from the gym after pumping this heavy iron and go to lift their child, and boom, there goes the back. And they reach into the back seat of the car, and there goes the rotator cuff. And they're not doing the core exercise that we describe in the book. Yoga is a perfect example. As far as stress, it's a little bit more complicated. The stress hormones, if you do pop one of those pimples, a plaque, all the stress hormones will increase the rate that you develop, that will increase the size of the blood clot that you develop. They're, in a sense, thrombogenic. And that's one of the reasons why people under high stress sometimes, you know, have heart attacks. And the other clear areas for stress are after heart attacks. And some of this work was done at the University of Miami, that patients who are depressed, who have lost a spouse, who are under chronic stress, don't survive as long as patients with good social interactions. So stress definitely plays a role, and so does exercise. And if you can combine something like yoga that does core exercise, but also relaxation, that's wonderful. Yes. Kraft actually has been fabulous. And you know, in deciding, just like we chose, you know, South Beach Diet as the name of the book, though we thought some people might not take it as seriously, once the book was successful, I had a special opportunity to really help change the way America eats. And I would like it if we all went back a few generations and had family meals cooked from scratch with whole food. And that's absolutely ideal. And we could have, really pushed that as a primary cause, and we could have partnered with Grandma's Organic Farm, but we wouldn't have had much of an impact on the country, quite frankly. And what I felt strongly is to help change the way America eats. Number one, we have to start in the schools, and our research foundation is doing a school program where we've shown that you can change the way kids eat when you start in elementary school. But the other is to make good food more convenient, fast food healthier. We found at the beginning of the book, people who I called foodies who love to cook and shop did great, stayed on the diet, no problem. But people on the run, invariably, they lost weight, but stress, running around, would cause the problem when they couldn't plan ahead. And so we felt very strongly that we had to partner with a corporation that could make a difference and was willing. We had a lot of people approach us, you know, make just bars and shakes, and we wanted a complete approach, and Kraft understood and were willing to do it. There are compromises you make when you process and have frozen foods. One of the problems with sodium, which we've working on getting down, and the technology, not only in diagnostic tests, but food technology, it's getting easier and easier to put omega-3 into foods, to put more fiber into foods, to get sodium content down. But we have veto power over all the foods, and I think overall, you know, they're absolutely excellent. And, you know, there are some compromises, you know, particularly as a general rule, we like the sodium lower in some of the products, and that's happening. But we have a lot of cases where it's really, really helped secretaries, you know, bring the wraps to work on planes. I love to have them, you know, bring the bars when I can't have a full meal. And so it's working extremely well, and they're improving the products all the time. Yes. It doesn't help varicose veins. Yeah. Right. Yeah. No, the veins are not affected either way by heart healthy diets. It's really a separate problem that has more to do with weight, with genetics. It's sometimes called the surgeon's disease. Surgeons who are standing up all the time, the blood just, you know, pools in their legs and dilates the veins. And so it is, it's a separate problem, not related to general heart health. It is related to weight, and weight is a big risk factor. Once the varicose veins have developed, they won't go away with just weight loss. They'll be prevented in the first place with weight loss. But overall, it's a separate problem. Yes. It's hard. The heart scanning does take, yeah, the heart scanning takes a good machine and really a lot of quality assurance. And there are, your best bet is to go to a place that's really established. The medical centers, you know, Dr. Ehrlich here has a center that's been open for years with excellent equipment and a lot of experience. It's theoretically possible to have a mobile scanner that is good and accurate. You might have your doctor do some, you know, do some research as well as to that particular company. So that's not the heart scan that she's doing. Okay, because there are a few places where they put the CAT scanner in a mobile truck. Yeah, but this is something else. And they do that in Miami also. And it's helpful if they do find something, but if they report the test is negative, it's finding disease. It's a little bit on the late side. So it doesn't find, you know, early disease. And so... Well, Dr. Ehrlich is here. You should go to Dr. Ehrlich's center. And I'm not saying that Dr. Ehrlich happens to be a friend and colleague for many years, but he has the absolute best scanning, the best quality assurance. Because the cravings are due to exaggerated swings in blood sugar. It's what we call insulin resistance. It was actually a survival mechanism for early man. It's hormonal changes when we add some amount of belly fat and get what we call insulin resistance. You get bigger swings in the best example in the book, in the documentary Supersize Me, I don't know if you saw that, where the hero eats out at a fast food restaurant for a month. And, you know, after about 3 weeks, he develops insatiable cravings. That's where he's swelled the size of the fat cells in his belly, which are different than fat cells elsewhere in the body. And that causes these really wild swings in blood sugar where you're hungry soon after you eat. For early man, that meant that when food was available and you began, say, in the summer, fall months, you would eat some excess calories. Some would be stored in your belly as fat. That would cause some of these hormonal changes, so you'd be hungrier when food was available. You'd eat more, develop a reserve in your belly, and that helped you survive the winter famine. When we only have feasts, we have no famine. Americans, and 40% of Americans, at least, over the age of 40, have these hormonal changes. We're walking around hungry all the time. What the diet does is it, especially the first phase of the diet, which is the first phase appropriate for people who have cravings, who have substantial belly fat to lose. It stabilizes the blood sugar and insulin levels so you don't have the cravings. And at the beginning, we talk about strategic snacking to have some regular snacks which prevent the big drops in blood sugar. Because once blood sugar drops and causes cravings, self-control will not work. But they're not hard to prevent when you're eating the right foods.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for Tracy Chevalier, Rachel Johnson, Jonathan Lethem, Sarah Davidson, Craig Childs, and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on March 13th, 2007.